You're listening to a stage talk titled Tracking Deforestation with Open Data. This week, we were joined by journalist Luis Fernando Toledo, who has spent time recently investigating cases of deforestation in Brazil. He worked with publications in Brazil like Piauí and large investigative collectives like the OCCRP and the ICIJ to uncover the scale of wrongdoing and missed accountability within this industry. In the talk, we explored his research techniques and findings, but he also gave some sound advice on getting started in environmentally focused investigations. You can find all the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday, the 29th of August, 2024, in the Bellingcat Discord server.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's stage talk. Today, I'm joined by freelance investigative journalist and researcher at the Cambridge Center of Development Studies, Luis Fernando Toledo. Luis has a master's in data journalism from Columbia University and has spent the last few years publishing investigations into the hidden world of deforestation offenders. He specializes in using open data methods to uncover gaps in regulation systems that are allowing companies and individuals to pursue environmental damage without consequences. For the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICFJ, for example, Luis recently revealed how environmental certifications were still given to companies that have committed environmental crimes in Brazil. Today's talk will hopefully provide you with some insight into the scale of the issue at hand and demonstrate how you can use research techniques to cover environmental crimes and deforestation in general yourself. As we talk, please put your questions in the chat, as I just mentioned, and I'll ask them as we move into the Q&A section. Reminder that if you do not want me to mention your username, please mention that in your question. Now I'm going to hand over the mic to Luis, who's going to detail some of his most recent investigations. Luis.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me. Can you hear me? Okay. So I'm a reporter who has worked for around 10 years with public policies in Brazil in various areas such as crime, public education, and more recently, the environment bit. Today, I continue covering my country, but I'm based in London for several media outlets. Before I begin, I just want to clarify that I'm not primarily an environmental reporter. I'm a reporter who loves public records and data, using them to uncover stories whenever possible. However, due to certain professional paths and partnerships, most of my recent work has focused on environmental issues. Before leaving Brazil, I worked for several media outlets and also created a nonprofit organization in partnership with other journalists, specializing in obtaining data and documents through our access to information law, something like the Freedom of Information Act in the US or the FOI in the UK. Later, I created another project called datafixers.org, specializing in data in Brazil, with funding from the Brown Institute for Media Innovation, an institute based at Columbia University and other partners. The goal of this project is to produce stories and assist other journalists in crafting their own by obtaining the necessary documents and data from any Brazilian agencies, companies, and other sources. It's important to say that Brazil is a giant country with many, many challenges in its journalistic coverage. But we are also, in a way, an example of transparency and open data. A lot of information is already available on the internet and can be extremely useful in finding exclusive stories. I want to use this presentation today to bring some examples and encourage anyone interested in investigating environmental crimes in the Amazon or other Brazilian regions to use these open source websites and methodologies. Even if you are not from Brazil, and I think most of you are not from Brazil, I hope the strategies that I will share here will help you find stories that connect Brazil to your country. This is increasingly relevant, especially when it comes to deforestation, climate change, and environmental crimes. The examples I will share have one thing in common. People and companies that sell their products in the United States and Europe and other regions presenting themselves as sustainable, environmentally conscious, law-abiding, but they often fail to explain or even know the origin of the products they sell, how they were manufactured, or where the raw material came from. Another common thread is that all these projects relied on open data, public records, and many, many freedom of information requests, I'm going to repeat this thing all the time, freedom of information, FOIA, etc., because I use it a lot. I have been working to find these networks, the supply chains, and expose that this solid image these companies present in rich countries may be hiding a trail of environmental crimes and even violence against people, animals in other countries, such as Brazil. This applies to almost everything. The timber used for tables, chairs, and decks in New York, violin bowls crafted for use in London and Belgium, rare indigenous artifacts that you can see in museums in Germany or that are sold online in online stores around the world. In some countries like the US, there are laws stating that if an action constitutes an environmental crime in the country of origin, then it's also considered a crime there. It's worth keeping an eye on cases involving those countries, even if they occur in Brazil, for example. I believe some other countries have similar laws. And where should I start a project like this? Many of these stories can be investigated with a combination of interviews, research into official sources, data cross-referencing. There's no need to have a super source who works in a high-ranking government position or a company, or having a huge leak in your head. So of course, if you have a leak, sometimes it's better, but you don't really need to start with something huge like a leak or a source like that. All the stories that I have participated in over the last 3 years almost always started with a hypothesis and questions that arose from reading reports, analyzing spreadsheets, talking to normal people. Of course, the data was just the beginning of the investigation. A lot of on-the-field reporting happened in some of these stories. Some traditional investigative reporting steps too, like talking to former employees from companies or government agencies. But having something you have found in public records before an interview is always an advantage. If you have data, use it to start the conversation. Make your source interested in what you're doing. It's much better. People often say that every story is unique, and that's true. Every project is different. But what I try to think, I like to say that there's always a journalistic methodology to follow, even if it ultimately leads to different paths. So how to get this data and public records in Brazil? We have a powerful access to information law, or FOIA, which allows anyone to request data and documents from any public department, and in some cases, even data from companies that receive public funds. It's free to use. Anyone can request it, regardless of their country of origin. This is a recent law, only approved in 2012 in Brazil. Other Latin American countries approved similar laws a decade earlier. In the United States, for example, such a law has existed for more than 50 years, FOIA, famous FOIA. However, being late has brought us some advantages. By arriving later, most documents and data have already been digitized. In Brazil, there is a single, just one website to send questions to any federal public agency and even some municipal and state agencies. Questions are usually answered within 30 days, and only a few agencies are late. So this is great for investigative journalists. This is very, very useful. Don't expect, of course, to get all the documents you are asking for. To increase your chances, it's important to find alternatives, interview sources before, so they can explain where to get the information and how. Learn how documents are named, how data is organized. Bureaucracy is a puzzle. We need to understand each piece. Precisely because the Freedom of Information Act is a new law in Brazil, only a few journalists take advantage of the law and prefer to follow the more traditional path of reporting. In 2021, I received this scholarship to study data journalism in the United States, and that's where I learned how to program in Python. I won't say that programming is mandatory, but it makes everything so much easier for investigative reporters. You can scrape an entire website and its data, transform it in a spreadsheet, gathering social media data, create dashboards to help your colleagues in a project, analyze historical trends, cross-reference huge data sets, monitor websites even without looking at it all day. These are just some examples. So, and it was during that program that I realized the environmental bit would be the best way to attract interest from journalists in other countries. As Brazil, especially in the Amazon region, is consistently on the radar of reporters in the United States and Europe. During this degree at Columbia University, I was invited to help a professor, Janina Segnini, in one project. She was investigating the illegal export of garbage from the United States to Brazil. I helped her team to obtain, through the Access to Information Law, copies of several environmental files and reports that proved that there had been such an export of garbage by a large company, including pictures. It was during this project that I discovered a very powerful research source that I'm going to talk about, which became the main source of almost all the stories I have produced in the last 3 years. It's the Brazilian Environmental Crime Database. Brazil has two main government institutes that monitor environmental crimes, IBAMA and ICMBio. IBAMA is spelled A-B-A-M-A, and ICMBio is spelled I-C-M-B-I-O. These two government agencies are responsible for imposing fines on those who commit illegal deforestation, export wood illegally, sell materials taken from endangered species. There are other agencies, of course, but the main sources are these two, IBAMA and ICMBio. All these environmental fines, along with the paper trail detailing what happened, are public. This is, again, like an advantage of covering Brazil. You can see, you can get a lot of public information for free. Part of this information is available in huge spreadsheets in the CSP format, and it's also available in a shapefile format, which can be opened in software such as QGIS. Details of each case can be requested through the Access to Information Law. So to do these stories, we need all the formats. The CSV to identify potential interesting cases, the shapefile to map those cases and look for insights, and the Freedom of Information Act to get more details about the cases we want to highlight. The spreadsheet contains the basic data of people and companies, such as their full name and ID, which crime they committed, where, and the date when it happened. It's a good practice for journalists to cross-reference the spreadsheet, which is updated daily by the federal government, with other databases, such as tax exemptions given by the government, politicians and their companies. In Brazil, you can see the politician ID, so you can cross-reference those databases, public employees, etc. So you can find who from those people is being investigated for environmental damage and maybe find a potential story. This is where the first project I want to talk about comes in. I was part of a project coordinated by ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, in 2023 called Deforestation Inc. The project, or at least the Brazilian part of the project, was based on that specific data set, the environmental crime data set in Brazil. The main conclusion of the project was that major environmental auditing firms ignore or fail to recognize environmental damage caused by loggers and other clients whose practice they certify as sustainable, undermining an elaborate global system meant to fight deforestation and climate change. The project involved 39 media partners, including 3 Brazilian news outlets. I was responsible for coordinating the data analysis for the Brazilian news outlet. So I can't speak for the other countries, but I can say that Brazilian had a very important role in this project. To establish a starting point for that project, we decided to focus on only one of these certifications, the Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, which is an international non-government organization dedicated to promoting responsible management of the world's forests. Since its foundation in 1994, in their own words, FSC has grown to become the world's most respected and widespread forest certification system. According to the organization itself, they are pioneers in certificating systems that enables business and consumers to choose wood, paper, and other forest products made with material that support responsible forestry. So an organization like that shouldn't be involved with companies that have committed environmental crimes, right? At the time of our investigation, the FSC provided an online dashboard with data separated by country, where it was possible to see all the companies that had the certification and when they got the certification. So we scraped the data from the website to convert to the spreadsheet. We shared that spreadsheet with all the partners, and then we cross-referenced the list of environmental fines from IBAMA in Brazil and the other countries involved in spreading their own context. To do this, we use the technique called fuzzy matching in Python. It searches for similar terms in different data tables and then aggregates that data based on proximity. This was necessary because sometimes there were slight differences how the company names were written. we identified dozens of names. Then we manually checked whether they were the same companies. To obtain more details of the cases, our reporter submits a request through the Freedom of Information Law to obtain copies of each fine and search court records regarding the company's owners. As a result, we found companies with SSC certification that had already been convicted for land grabbing in indigenous lands, illegal deforestation, timber laundering, a fraud scheme that's very common in Brazil. Companies that have been fined several times, yet FSC certification had not been canceled after the fines were issued. Some company owners have been arrested for environmental crimes, but kept their certification. So this project, only using data, of course, we did all the field reporting after that, but the data was the starting point, and we found several interesting cases that we could highlight. In another project for Piauí, a major Brazilian magazine, we used similar environmental fines data from ICMBio. Again, this is the source of many, many potential stories. A Brazilian public institute responsible for monitoring conservation units with protected species. But in this case, the spreadsheet seemed to have an error that in data journalism, we commonly refer as missing data. Nearly half of the environmental crimes were not attributed to any person or company. They were either left blank or listed as unknown author. To confirm if this was indeed a data issue, I selected some cases without a known name and requested copies of these fines from the government through the Freedom of Information Law. The result confirmed that they had no information on the individuals involved. It was not a data problem. It was a public policy problem and a story for us. How is it possible to sanction someone without knowing who that person is? Is the government simply pretending to do something? Acting on a tip from a source, we discovered there was a way to identify landowners at least in one place, the state of Pará in Brazil, one of the states with the highest levels of deforestation in the country and a key supplier of beef to the global market. There was this local government website that allowed to visualize rural properties data through individual searches and also via shapefile. So I had two spatial files. One shapefile with the locations where environmental crimes had occurred, created by the federal government, but without the author's name. And there was this another shapefile with the names of the landowners in the state of Pará, produced by a local government, including the exact location of each farm. So we just had to intersect those shapefiles, and then we would know the name and the crime, something that I assumed that the government would do, but later a source warned me that data sharing is not exactly something that is very common in the government. So, okay, the federal government has this database, the state government has another database, but they don't speak to each other, so a journalist can't do that. Using a simple merge technique in QGIS, we identified more than 30 names of people and companies who were responsible for large-scale deforestation in the state of Pará. Based on those findings, the government, as far as I could track, has already fined at least 5 companies millions of Brazilian reais for illegal deforestation. Finally, I want to mention one last example that also used a similar methodology relying on open data, where we identified a large group of companies exporting Brazil wood to manufacture violin bows and sell them in the United States and Europe. The story began with a press release issued by the federal government announcing the seizure of a large quantity of wood at Brazil's largest airport. However, the press release did not mention any names, only saying that a major manufacturer was involved. Using the data, the date of the incident, the quantity of wood seized, and the location, I was able to identify one of the offenders. His name appeared in the environmental crime database, again, I mentioned earlier, and began investigating him by reviewing court cases filed against him. I discovered that he was just one of many sellers, part of a network that included several others, some with connections to well-known musicians in Brazil and abroad. I submitted so many FOIA requests regarding these cases that after a few weeks, a source familiar with my requests just reached out to me, confirming I was on the right track. The source began guiding me on what to request next. So sometimes we are using FOIA, but we are also talking to someone. They are guiding us what to ask exactly, to where should we ask, and what is the question we need to ask? So I managed to map out the entire supply chain, revealing the story where the wood came from, a park in the state of Bahia, and how it eventually ended up in a store in London. We interviewed people in both places, Bahia and London, and the story was published by OCCRP, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. So just to finish my speech, all these examples demonstrate that even with official data, it's possible to draw conclusions that go beyond and sometimes even challenge the official narrative. And not all these stories are the same. There's always some steps we can try to follow to get the information we need. So even if each story is different, I like to think that there is a methodology in journalism. There isn't just one government. There are city governments, state governments, the federal government, along with the Congress, the judiciary, the public prosecutor's office. Many public policies and records are interconnected. So if we can't find what we are looking for from one source, we should seek out from other sources. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Luis. That was so interesting. And yes, definitely, you can see the methodology there. It's also frustrating to hear that the departments of government don't talk to each other. I think that's a common theme that seen across the globe, actually. I wanted to first start off the questioning, asking actually about the end result, because in a lot of cases where you're covering environmental crimes or destruction, it can feel pointless in some cases and like you're screaming into a void because of the scale of these kinds of gaps in legislation and also the destruction in itself. But you mentioned in the landowners ownership investigation where you were looking into the lack of clarity on owners of the land that had been deforested. You noted that in that investigation, you actually did find quite a number of the owners and that the government appeared to have fined 5 of them. How do you ensure when you've tracked down some of that missing data that your reporting has an impact on the ground and is used to rectify some of those issues? How did you push the government on that particular story?
So in this case, I think the strategy was to talk with the people who were responsible for sanctioning the landowners. So I was investigating and talking to them. So and they gave me more tips and I came back to my investigation. I had like several months to do that. So I wanted to make sure that when I published the story, I had material enough to make sure that they had what they needed to sanction those companies. So I think this helped a lot because I knew exactly what I needed because I was talking to those people. I didn't know, for example, that the federal government and the state government were not talking. The source told me that this happened. So that's why I decided to merge the two shape files. So I think one of the important things is to make sure that you have all the details, make sure that you have all the information you need. And of course, it won't be guaranteed. Maybe they would just ignore my story. But I think in this case, it would be impossible to ignore because I was talking to the people responsible for sanctioning the company. So how could they ignore something that they were helping me? So I think in this specific case, and as you said, it's like it's just something I was expecting that they would sanction many more people because I found 30 cases. They sanctioned only 5. I don't know about the rest of what happened to the rest of these landowners. And this was something that I found in three or four months. But I think if they investigate more, they could find many more people. But what I like to say about this story is that the most important impact was not the people who are sanctioned, but the methodology, because now they know that they should talk more with the state of Pará. They should speak more with people from other states and update their data, because this was done by just one person who is not even specialized in mapping. So they can do much, much more. So I think like changing the way these investigations are made is more helpful than just sanctioning one or two people.
And just on that topic, on that particular investigation, I thought it might be useful for people who might not be as familiar with the issue of deforestation, and particularly the issue of deforestation in the Amazon. How are the embargoes or the sanctions, as you mentioned, meant to work? How are they meant to be implemented, and how do they affect land use?
Oh, there were different cases. In this case, like this person in first place, this person was shouldn't be in that land. So the land grabbed that area from the government. It's a public area, but they allegedly said it was theirs. And that's how the process happened in Brazil. They occupy land and then they start to destroy the forest and they put cattle there. And after a few years, they ask the government to give them the area. So sometimes it works, but in this case, it didn't. So the government found that there was deforestation in that specific area. They sanctioned the area, but that's the problem. They put a sanction, but they didn't know who was the owner. So it was more like a rhetorical sanction because nobody was going to pay for that. So the piece that was missing was to find a person because in Brazil, you can sanction. I don't know how it works in other countries, but it's impossible to sanction a piece of land. Of course, you can put a sanction where people wouldn't be able to get loans from banks to do something in that land. If you have cattle in that land, it could be seized by the authorities. But in terms of giving a fine, in terms of sanctioning someone, arresting someone, you need a name from a person or a company. So the piece that was missing was that, like having someone responsible for that area.
As I expected, we're getting questions on FOI requests. I wanted to ask, actually, is there any common pitfalls that you see people falling into when filing FOI requests? And Peter, my colleague, has just asked, any advice for keeping track of the numerous requests you might have filed at once? Do you keep a database or a list?
Yeah, the first thing I like to do is to create one email just for FOIA requests, because I have, say, like 6,000 FOIA requests only to the federal government. So I realized that if I use like my professional account and I change my job, for example, I would lose like all the FOIA requests. So I created a Gmail only for FOIA requests. And because I need to keep track of 30 days where they give me a response and then I send them a PO, etc. So I prefer to have my own email. I don't have a spreadsheet or something like that, but just having a particular email just for FOIA requests, I found that this is very, very useful. And about like the pitfalls, one of the things that people ask the most is what's the difference between using FOIA requests or just asking the press office or something. And I would say the main difference is that press office, they send what they want, and in a FOIA request, you can ask whatever you want. One of the things that it's really important is that you don't need to explain yourself. You don't need to say that you are a journalist and you are doing a story about this or that. I know that, for example, in the US, some journalists, they like to explain what they are doing, because if they don't do that, the agency can charge for the request. But that's not a thing in Brazil. So you don't need to explain anything. Just go directly to the point. I need data about deforestation in this area, the names of people who have been sanctioned, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's it. You don't need to explain that you are a journalist or you are a researcher or that you are working for some organization. Just send your request. One thing that I like to do is to send, if I'm not sure about who is responsible for the information I need, and this is very common. So, for example, in Brazil, as I mentioned, we have two agencies, IBAMA and ICMBio. Sometimes I don't know exactly where to send my request, so I would just send both. I'll send a request to IBAMA and another one to ICMBio. There are other agencies, state agencies, so sometimes I can send you three or four. It's free. It's our right to send requests. So I think like some people feel guilty when they send something because they think they are giving someone else their own, like they are giving something that's their responsibility to another person, but that's not like it. It's all right. If you go to a public hospital, it's your right that a doctor will come and talk to you. So why would it be different with FOIA? FOIA is just asking the government to give the data that's not theirs. They are protecting the data, but the data is public. Everyone can access it.
Yeah, something that affects UK journalists a lot when they're filing FOI requests is making sure that they've selected the right department and making sure that they're emailing the right person as well. Because there's nothing worse than waiting 30 days for a response and then realizing you sent it to the wrong department. So that's also something to be aware of. And in the UK, they also trip you up slightly, and I don't know if it's the same in the US as well, but they try to trip you up by making sure that you know specifically what the data refers to or what the name of the data could be. It sounds like it's a bit more flexible in Brazil, which is fantastic. But that's something that is a very common issue in the UK, is not knowing particularly the specifics of the data. You have to kind of make almost a guess on what you are expecting to get back in your request to ensure that you get the right amount of data and the right data itself. Case has actually asked in the question in the chat, do you have any tips for formulating FOI requests?
The more precise, the better. So one of the things that I like to do is talking to someone who knows the data before. I like to say that FOIA is the last thing you use. First, you talk to people, then you read what's already available. You can talk to organizations that have the data. Sometimes, like in Brazil, we have one organization, and they have all the data about murders in Brazil. It's weird, but the government doesn't have the most updated data about murders. So if you want to know more about homicide, you need to go to this NGO. And how do they get that? They send FOIA requests to every Brazilian police department, and they gather the data and create an annual report. And that's better than the government does. So instead of sending FOIA requests to every state, you should just go to this NGO and ask them for the data. So the first thing I like to do is like do some research, find out if someone already has the data. And if they don't, try to find the most specific way of asking that question. In Brazil, we have a very useful database of FOIA requests, and this is kept by the government. It's called Busca CGU, where you can find more than 500,000 FOIA requests. So one of the things that I like to do is to look up in that database and see if someone has asked the same question before, how they asked, if the government gave the data or not. So I can think a little bit more about the strategy that I'm going to use to get the information I need. But if you don't have a database like that in your country, the best way is just to do some research, because as you said, it's awkward to wait for 30 days and then you don't have the information you need. So be precise. So if you want historical data, if you just ask for data, but you don't specify, I want this data divided by year, divided by city, divided by gender, by race, or whatever, then the government can give you whatever they want. So be very specific. Say exactly what you need. And even if you think they don't have the data in the way you want, just ask, because if you don't ask, you are not going to find out if they have it or not.
Very good advice. Tristan has just, my colleague has just shared in the chat, I've heard Kalina, one of our other colleagues, recommend 404 Media's FOIA forums. And then I've just also shared What Do They Know, which is the UK site that you can check against freedom of information requests. Also, just as an additional thing, I think it's really useful to check on these sites for how people have written their previous requests as well, as particularly if it's on similar data points, because then you can see what has been successful and what hasn't as well in terms of language. Really great tips there. You mentioned just before that you often check against other databases, see if anybody else is already collecting this kind of information. Do you have any recommended databases or organizations specifically for deforestation in Brazil that isn't the government or government related?
So the most famous is MapBiomas. So MapBiomas is very useful, and they have data. They have spatial data from everywhere. You can go to INPA. You can get some and just find the website.
If you're listening on the podcast, I'll include the links to these in the description of the podcast.
And there are some independent news outlets that I can't avoid, like Info Amazonia. They are independent news organization. They have a lot of useful data. There's another one called Ambiental Media. Let me just get their links. This is a new nonprofit organization, and they are very, very good in what they do. And they are starting to create like a data store where you can get some data for free, some data is paid, but it's very, very useful for investigations, because I think they are based on official data from the government, but they treat the data, they clean the data, so it's much easier to just go there and get what you need instead of going to the government website. But of course, for some cases, using official data is better. I'll just share the link for the IBAMA dataset that I mentioned several times.
Amazing, thanks. Fileface asked earlier, what outcomes have you seen from reporting on this? Have you seen any changes in certification at all? So you mentioned the outcomes from the landowner's investigation, but have you seen any changes or impact from your work with ICFJ, for example?
To be honest, I haven't been following up a lot on that story, so I'm not sure. I remember that when we asked them about what happened, the certification, they said something like, oh, but these are old cases, or we are always checking companies again to see if they have changed their behavior. Some of the companies said that the fines were old, so they are not doing that anymore, but that's not exactly true because they have been fined like several times. It's hard to say because in Brazil, environmental crime is not really taken seriously. So most part of the time, you just pay the fine, and the fine is not that expensive if you are a huge company, if you have like 1,000 cattle in your farm and paying like $10,000, $100,000 in Brazilian currency, of course, it's not a lot of money. So it's hard to say. Sometimes they just pay the fine and then their names are clean and that's okay. So I'm not sure. Maybe they will be more aware of who they are giving the certificates to, but I didn't get any specific feedback on this specific story so far.
Have you found trying to source funding for these types of investigations difficult or easy? And do you have any tips for anybody who might be looking to pitch environmentally focused stories to outlets?
So I would say that the environmental bit is one of the best to be a freelancer because there are many, many sponsors. So Pulitzer Center is a great sponsor. The Brown Institute for Media Innovation at Columbia University that I mentioned earlier gave me, I would say that it wouldn't be possible to be a freelancer without their support because they gave me like almost 2 years of support. And then I started from that to look for other partners. Muckrock, they gave me a grant a year ago to do some investigations. I forgot their name, just 1 sec, from Internews. Yeah, Earth Journalism Network, they give many, many grants for stories like that. One of the stories that I mentioned was done through a fellowship they did, the International Center for Journalists. So I think like it's hard to pitch, and I think like the first one is always the worst, but then you get used to it. I think like each person, each organization is different. So the best way is just looking previous projects they have sponsored before, and see like what their values are and what they expect from a story. And of course, you need to do some pre-reporting. It's impossible to pitch something if you don't have at least a part of your story already made. I try to pitch sometimes just with an idea, and I received a lot of no's because you really need to have at least like some interviews. You make sure that you have a minimal story. For OCCRP, for example, when I'm pitching a story for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, they have a form. And in this form, you need to put your minimal story and your maximum story. So the minimal story is like, I know that 10 companies have been sanctioned for doing this and that. And the maximum story is that they are an organized crime group who has been profiting millions and they have, I don't know. But of course, you can dream when you start your project, but you need to have at least something minimal because if you don't have that, they won't give you the money. If you can travel, if you have details about like the places where you plan to visit, this is the hardest part of pitching a project. It's like, how can you plan everything you are going to do in the next 6 months if you don't have the store yet? But sometimes like Pulitzer Center, they ask you to explain where you plan to travel, where's the hotel you're planning to stay, and how much is that hotel costs, how much is the flying ticket, etc. So if you can, try to plan as much as you can because they will ask you for that.
Really amazing advice. Thank you. Yeah. Speaking from the Bellingcat editorial team as well, we also ask for the minimal and maximum of your story. So if you were ever to pitch an environmental focused story to us, we'd also be looking for similar information, although you do not need to detail your travels or accommodation in our pitches. But yeah, that's a really, really good advice. You only have a couple of more minutes to pop in questions, so keep them coming, please, in the chat. I wanted to ask, Luis, what from the investigations, what were your biggest learnings, having kind of explored these data sets and finding kind of this array of data that is just producing endless investigations? What has been your biggest learning from these projects?
I'm not sure if I understood the question, sorry.
What have you learned from doing this research on these two and these three investigations that, in fact, that you mentioned?
Okay, so I think like the main thing is the methodology. So as I said, sometimes I think that the three stories are totally different. So I spoke with different people, I did different things, but the way I approached those stories was exactly the same. So I went to the data set, to the spreadsheet in this case with all the environmental crimes, and I asked some questions to that data. And then I spoke to people who worked for those offices. I spoke to people who worked for the companies in the past. So I believe there's a methodology. If there wasn't a methodology, there wouldn't be so many journalism schools around the world, investigative reporting workshops and things like that. So when I go to a journalism conference, I hear that all the time. Like you attend a conference, you attend a workshop, and they say there is no single way to do a story. And I agree with that, but there is a methodology. And in stories where you need to fact check, where you have data, where you have public records, you can at least try to do the same things. Of course, they won't work all the time. But at least you have something to start with. So, and one of the things that I like about working with data is that you won't find just a single story. You can find several stories. As I said, like just using this environmental crime database from IBAMA in Brazil, I have published, I have no idea about how many stories have been published based on that data set. And DataFixers, the project I mentioned earlier, supported by Columbia, the main source of this project is also the database. So there was this guy from Washington Post, and he wanted to do a story about environmental crime, and he asked me a few questions that I had no idea about how to answer him. So I used the database, and I found something that was useful for that journalist. There was another guy from Al Jazeera. He was investigating this politician who was involved in environmental crimes, and I used the database again, and I could help this journalist to write his story. So I think that when you the more you explore databases, the more stories you will find. So don't give up. I think this is it's a valuable tip. Don't give up on the important sources that you have, if it's a human source or a database like that, because sometimes you won't see the value of that source in the moment, but in the future, when you talk to someone or you are working on a different project, just go back and try to find, maybe you will find something valuable. That's what I learned in this project. I'm still using the same database for several different purposes.
Really useful. Sorry to take you back, but Fellface has just asked how much information goes into a maximum story if, like he says, you haven't looked into it yet. So from Bellingcat's point of view, I just said it is what you think you might likely find. This could be a paragraph on what you suspect you might come across in the data. However, the minimal is what you've already found slash ready to substantiate. So how much detail, how much information do you usually give in pitches where you're asked to give a maximum story? How do you navigate how much information you add there and what you can research beforehand?
I like to say that the maximum story is the dream. So, if you want to write the story of your life, the story that you are going to share with everyone, this is the maximum story. Of course, you should talk about things that you think you can prove. Of course, you won't say like something absurd. But for example, I wrote a story about These people who were extracting Brazil wood, a rare type of timber in Brazil, they were extracting that timber illegally, making violin bows and selling those bows to Europe, to some stores in London. The minimal story was that I had a group of guys who were doing that for like a decade. That was the minimal story. But I suspected that these guys were not like just some people. They were an organized crime group involved with very dangerous people who were involved in murder, in other types of crime, and they were working together because they could launder money from what they are doing with timber and then support other crimes. So I couldn't prove that when I started the project, but because I had at least some tips, some source telling me that that was going on, so that was the maximum story. The minimum story, some people are exporting timber illegally and making violin bows in Europe. Maximum story, these people are part of a larger organized crime group who is using the money to do other crimes.
Really useful. It might be nice as well if you have any links to these stories, including the wood one that you mentioned earlier, if you could just add them into the chat, Louise, because I couldn't find that specific example. And I'm sure people who are
Yes.
listening would love
Oh,
to
sure.
access it.
The English version is short. In Portuguese, we publish like three or four different articles, but this is summarized in English. Yeah,
Amazing.
there are two stories in English. This is the other one.
Thank you. And I'll include those links in the podcast description as well if you're listening back on the podcast. We have time for a last few questions. So if you want to pop in a final question, please do in the chat. You've mentioned quite a few ways that perpetrators have been using policies and procedures within Brazil to avoid taking responsibility. Is there any particular databases or procedures that you've come across that you feel could be useful to investigate further if anybody's listening to this and looking for a new investigative project?
So, one of the most common ways of avoiding being sanctioned is to use a proxy. And there's a very effective method to find proxies in Brazil, which is the social, how can I say that in English? Social benefits database. So, if you are a poor person in Brazil, you can have access to many, many social benefits. And your name will appear on the Transparency portal, Transparency website. It's called Portal da Transparência. Let me just give you the link. In most cases, what the criminals do, what they do, they hire someone, and it's usually a poor person, a person who cannot defend themselves. And then they put the farm in the name of that person. They put their company in the name of that person. This person is the proxy. But how can I know if this person is a proxy or not? Oh, if you are being sanctioned for 10 million reais because you have destroyed a piece of land, about I don't know, a huge piece of land, it's unlikely that you'll be receiving a benefit from the government. So the first step we like to do is to cross-reference the data of the people we think is a proxy with that database of social benefits. The most important social benefit in Brazil, it's called Bolsa Família. I'll just put the name here. So there is a database for Bolsa Família. There are other social benefits. During the pandemic, there was this social aid called Auxílio Emergencial. It's another way to find the proxies. So I think this is very useful because it's the first way to look up some names and find relationships. I think it's also important to mention this project. I just give the link here. It's called Cruzagrafos. Cruzagrafos is an amazing project where they try to create connections between people, companies, and politicians in a visualization. So I won't be able to show it here, but you just look up the name of a company, of a person that you are investigating, and then if you click twice on the name, it will open all the connections of that person with a company. If this person owns a company, if they are a director in a company, in a nonprofit, etc., you will see the connection between the person and the company, and you can just continue clicking. So it will open more and more and more connections until you have something that is interesting to you. And in this they are updating this database now to include environmental crimes. So if you are investigating a person, you just put the name of that person there, and then you keep clicking, and it will show their companies. And if they have an environmental fine, it will show up there. So this platform is very, very useful to investigate any person or companies that have any business in Brazil.
Amazing. Really useful to be aware of some of these sites and databases. Obviously, we've spoken a lot about Brazil. Is there any particular organizations you'd point people towards on a wider global scale? Or if there isn't, no problem, because I know you've been focusing in on Brazil itself.
Yeah, I've been working with two nonprofit organizations, but I think like most people know about them. So Global Witness is one that is supporting me in many, many different projects. And there's another one called CCCA. I always forget what it means. Let me just check. It's Center for Climate Crime Analysis. They are very, very good in fighting environmental crime in places we have no idea. So it's a very good source. They are based in Europe, but they do a lot of things in Brazil. But if you want to find more things in other countries, I think they are a very good source to reach out.
Amazing. Thank you, Tristan, also for linking it. I also wanted to shout out oxpeckers.org, which is Africa's first investigative environmental journalism unit. I've worked with them previously. And if you're looking at areas within their regions, might be worth reaching out to them as well, because they use a lot of satellite data to track environmental crimes, organized criminal syndicates. So definitely have a look at that and have a look at some of the tools that they have on their site as well, because they develop tools exactly for those kinds of things, those kinds of monitoring, which is really useful. Last question from me, and then if we have time for anything else, I'll pop it in at the very end. Oh, Godin, Jake Godin, who's also a colleague of mine, has just shouted out EIA, which is an environmental investigation agency as well, at eiainternational.org. But as I said, I'll include all of these in the chat. So we've spoken a lot about databases and how you've used them in the past, how you've developed a methodology. What would be your final advice to anyone listening who is looking to start in environmental-focused investigations, hasn't even put their foot in the door yet? What advice would you give them if they're passionate about the environment but haven't quite tipped their toe in investigations yet? What advice would you give?
I like to say that you need to start with a minimum story. So if you have a huge project in your heads, of course, congratulations, but sometimes we don't. So start with something, a story in your city, a story in your neighborhood. There's always an environmental story, an interesting environmental story, and it's an infinite world. There are many, many ways of approaching, of doing those stories, many tools, many databases. So if we try to do everything in a single story, it's impossible. So I like to start with something simple, with a short story. So like the first story I did was like about a politician who was responsible for committing an environmental crime in his property. And that was it. Just one story about this specific case. But because of that, I found out that this guy had other properties, and the other properties were also involved in environmental crime. So there was another story that I could do. So start simple. Start with just one project. Sometimes we don't even have a story. We just have like, we found out how to use QGIS. Write a blog post about how to use QGIS. I spent like 5 years doing a newsletter about FOIA. It's called Don't Lie to Me, because lie is the acronym for freedom of information in Brazil. So and that was it. I didn't have a story, but I spent 5 years writing a newsletter to help other journalists do use FOIA in their projects. And it was very helpful, because I found out many, many things about reporting, about how to use FOIA in reporting. So start with something that you know you can do, and that makes you happy, that makes you satisfied. Because if you don't do that, you're just going to give up. And that's it. I think the way to get to bigger projects is to start with something simple.
Really good advice. So you never know what you might find out. Is the newsletter still active? I'm interested. I know a lot of researchers that would benefit from that.
yeah, it's still active. I'm not doing it anymore, but I just keep doing.
Amazing. I will make sure to include that as well within the Discord, within the recording notes. All right. I think it's time to call it. Thank you so much, Louise, for your time today and your invaluable knowledge on covering environmental investigations. Thank you to everybody who attended as well and for being in the audience. And this recording will be up next week on our podcast platforms. Keep an eye on it, but I'll post it in the Discord announcements channel when it's ready. Also, pay attention if you're interested in covering environmental crime or environment in general. We do have channels within this Discord server that are there for you to explore and collaborate with each other, including the Environment Wildlife channel, which is often populated by Bellingcat environmental journalists, including Peter, who's on this audience right now. Tristan's just shared the link to it in the chat. So please do check that out if you're interested in exploring some of these topics further. And yeah, thank you so much, Louise, again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I attended many, many sessions from Bellingcat, and I had no idea that at some point that you would invite me to speak. So thank you very much, and thank you for your time, for your patience. And if you have any questions, if you want anything from Brazil, just reach out.
Definitely. Thank you so much, everybody. Take care, and I will see you in 2 weeks' time for the next Stage Talk. Bye. Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.